forecasting and planning, it doesn't exist when you only have a year's worth of cash. And like, you need to execute on the customers that you have right now to get more cash, to be able to hire an additional dev, to handle the additional bandwidth, to build something that somebody's asking for.
This is Retained Learnings, a podcast where Canadian finance leaders share strategic advice and potential solutions to answer some of the finance department's most important questions. I'm your host, Rob Kazam, the founder and CEO of Float. Thanks for listening, and I hope you learned something from today's episode.
Great to have you on the podcast, Chris. Thanks for coming. Well, maybe to start, can you introduce yourself to listeners? Who are you? What's your job? And tell us a little bit about the company you work for.
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Chris Chan. I am currently the head of finance at a company called NAC. We're a Series A, although I'll call it a late Series A, company in the MarTech space. We do email and landing page creation for enterprise grade companies. So we're primarily working with the Googles, the Amazons, the Metas of the world. And I am able to actually flex that I'm not just picking the sexiest examples. Those are actually our customers. I joined the company about 5 years ago. It's my first industry gig. So it's been a wild ride for somebody that didn't really know what they were getting into when they accepted the job offer. It's been a very fun ride.
Nice. So going back maybe to the very beginning, I love to ask people this question. How did you decide on finance as a career? What led you to that path? If you look back to maybe your upbringing in school, how did you land in a career in finance?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that most people would answer this way, that it was a happy accident. But maybe some people were a little bit more intentional about their path to finance than I was. When I was in high school, like grade 12, applying to university, I took a lot of like really hard sciences in high school, biochem, physics, math, the whole bit. And I went to a private school that didn't have like the normal range of courses offered. So there was actually like no business classes, no accounting classes, no finance classes. The closest thing I took was grade 12 economics. And one day during university application season, my mom came home from a meeting with her and my dad's like corporate accountant. And she was like, Chris, you might really like accounting. And so for lack of a better idea of what to do, because I had been sort of researching career paths for hard science and none of them really screamed stability, I went into accounting. I applied to a whole bunch of accounting programs and I got into accounting and I did some co-ops. And I was decent at it. And I took a job with a local accounting firm. They took me on for all of my co-ops and hired me full time afterwards. And that was, I'll say, very formative. I don't know that I would say enjoyable. I don't know a lot of people that would call public accounting enjoyable, but I will say that it was very formative, just in terms of how to work hard, sometimes you just got to stick your nose to the grindstone and get it done. Learned a lot about technical accounting and the background of it all. And then one of my clients was NAC. And so at one year end meeting, we were finishing up their taxes and they came in and Pierce, the CEO, basically said, hey, you know, we're looking for an accountant to join the company. If you know anyone that's looking, please let us know. And I sort of scurried home that night and wrote him an email and says, hey, like, and a whole bunch about your company, about the compliance environment of your company. And I don't know a ton about operational accounting, admittedly, but I think it would be super fascinating to learn. And if you'd bring me on to learn and see if I can build the plane while I fly it, then I would love to join your company. And he took a dice roll, and I think I also took a bit of a dice roll. It was a bootstrapped company with about $1 million of ARR at the time.
What space was the company in?
This is the same company that I'm currently in. It's MarTech, just like email and landing page creation. Back then it was like transitioning out of being like, I don't know how much you know about the email space, but when you're generating like high quality HTML emails, it's a bit of a zoo. It's like every developer's worst nightmare is to become an email HTML developer. And so the company was transitioning between like template generation and sort of like WYSIWYG email codeless generation or no code generation. I can never remember which one of those two is the thing I'm supposed to say, but one of them is the one I'm supposed to say. It was a very exciting thing for me, getting out of public accounting. And I think one of the issues that I had with public accounting is that you never get to see anything to completion, right? Like you see a company, you tell them their tax bill. They're like, great, thanks. I'll pay this and don't talk to me again for another, you know, year. And you do get a lot of breadth of experience. You see a lot of different business models. You see a lot of different accounting problems, tax situations, stuff like that. But you don't really get to take anybody. You don't get to like operationally affect anything, which was the part that I really felt like it was missing from what I wanted.
Yeah. And prior though to your corporate career, like you spent time in a small business, you owned and operated a small business. When you think back to that experience, what did you tell listeners what you were doing and maybe how that influenced your later career in finance?
Yeah, I honestly forget about that a lot. I think that's still on my LinkedIn, the student works painting or which, yeah. Yeah. So student works painting, for anyone who's listening, who has any idea of what like college pro or student works are, they're like business schemes basically to get university students to run a business under, a franchise setting to do painting or window washing, sort of like low skill labor things, but it's just sort of it's like a business execution question. I did that one summer in university. And that was, again, I wouldn't say necessarily enjoyable, but very formative, in that you kind of learn the realities of just like facing up to the promises that you make. I think my brother is a business owner, and one of the things that he says that I really like is basically just, you know, being a business owner is just making promises and then forcing yourself to keep them. And I'm sure as a business owner, you can probably feel the weight of that on your shoulders. I'm not a business owner, or I haven't been in quite a while, but yeah, it was an interesting thing. I probably did about $50,000-$60,000 of sales that summer, and executed all of the like painting work behind it. I probably did half the painting myself. And I think it just forces you to have a bit more empathy when it comes to, you know, when people do things that are irrational, it's only irrational because you don't understand either what they're thinking or what they're feeling. And it's not necessarily a finance lesson, but I think just like interacting with people, it's a really important thing to realize that, like, you know, people are irrational, but they're only irrational because you're not inside their head. Nobody does anything that's irrational to them. They just do things that it all makes sense to everybody internally. And so if you can't figure out how to make sense of it, it's just because you don't necessarily understand their point of view. I think that's probably the biggest thing that I still take with me from that. And also that painting sucks.
Everyone looks at their own window, right?
Yeah, 100%.
So now I guess fast forwarding back up to NAC, where you are now, as you mentioned earlier, like when you joined, it was a very different company, right? You joined there, I think it was about 5 years ago. Joined as a controller, you're now the head of finance, company's grown, the function has grown. What was it like when you first joined, and what was most surprising stepping into that business as the controller? I don't know if you were the first finance hire or not. Like, what did you find there that was maybe scary or daunting in your first couple of months, realizing the sort of realities of being in an early stage business?
Yeah, and I will say that there was a certain level of ignorance is bliss I had come from public accounting, doing sort of small business taxes and, you know, a bit of bookkeeping, some tax planning, stuff like that. And it's just exporting a trial balance is a very different thing than being the guy that has to put everything into the QuickBooks instance. So I think in terms of things that were really surprising to me was the degree or the speed with which I went from being an outsider to being like, you know, I'm the new guy, specifically the new finance guy, which I think is I think everybody sort of gets new guy syndrome a little bit, but when you're the new guy and you're being given the passwords to the bank accounts and the bank card and the payables system and the receivables system, the Visa, the credit cards and all of that, like there's a bit more that has to be that the people handing off to you have to let go of in order for you to do your job effectively, especially as the first finance hire. And I think that really surprised me. I hadn't really thought about it coming into the role. I had been doing a lot of research about like, well, how does QuickBooks work? Like, how do you actually use QuickBooks? And when it came into being handed the keys to the entire FinOps setup, there was like, I was actually doing the FinOps for two companies at the same time. So my CEO has another company that he founded back in like 2012 or something like that. It's a Marketo consultancy, or I guess it's more now, it's a RevOps consultancy, but it started out as a Marketo consultancy. And when I started at NAC, I was actually the controller for both companies at the same time. And so I went from being this like, you know, mid-20s kid doing tax returns that go through five levels of review before anything gets filed to being the guy releasing, you know, a quarter to a million, you know, basic, probably something like $250,000 of payments every month to just, you know, either clear out payroll or contractors or pay for software, stuff like that. And I was like, this is an insane amount of money for me to be handling with almost no oversight. Coming from the complete opposite end of the world where just like nobody does the degree of separation of duties in a public accounting firm, because you don't want to like mess up your compliance, is really intense. So that was a big surprise for me. I think also just the number of the number of manual things that need to get done. I think especially in Canada, and like this, well, this isn't intentionally a plug for Float, but I will bring it up because I think you guys have done something that's really special. That like the Canadian fintech scene is such a disaster because there are very few problems in the Canadian fintech scene that American fintech companies want to adapt for, because it's just a way bigger TAM. It's like a bigger bang for your buck to develop on the American infrastructure. And then adapting it to Canadian infrastructure, the additional TAM that you unlock, especially in tech companies and like fintech forward companies in Canada, is just not that big, I find. Well, I guess you would know better than I would, being the guy selling to them all. But I was very surprised at like how many things were being done manually. I was doing bank runs every other day. I was like writing checks every other day. I was like, this is absolute insanity. Like this is, you could hire a monkey to do this. This is like such, but there's so many jobs in Canadian fintech or in Canadian finance departments that are literally just like, okay, I'm going to count up all the checks and record it in NetSuite. And then I'm going to give the envelope of checks to somebody else to go to the bank so that there's separation of duties. And it's just this like crazy thing. I learned about all of the like really silly, we were TD Small Business Banking at the time, and TD Small Business Banking is great if you're a small business, but the moment you graduate to like needing some commercial services, like the ability to send wires from your house, the ability to deposit checks from your house, the ability to receive wire details from your house, it turns into this like insane set of microservices that you need a separate login for everything. And so I started to like accumulate all these services because I was like, I don't want to spend 3 hours a week doing bank runs. This is ridiculous. It's like 10% of my time is spent doing bank runs, which is a horrible value. So yeah, I think realizing the state of, or the degree of manual operations that existed, at least at NAC. I don't know. I have to imagine it's a pretty typical setup, to be honest, just like thinking about how tech forward the company that I moved into was and how manual it all was, and like the amount of research that I had to do to go and find tools that would automate stuff for me. That was a big shock coming into like a first finance seat role at NAC.
Thanks for sharing. I mean, covered lots of great stuff. Obviously, the realities of coming into an early stage team, the challenges in Canadian fintech, as you mentioned, the long list of microservices. Obviously it's a burden, right? Like it's a burden on the modern finance team's time, and there are integrated solutions are the answer, but there's just not enough folks doing it. So great to hear it, and not necessary, but appreciate the shout out for Float. I'm curious, what would you say to someone? I want to ask you about the later experiences as you built that function out, but what would you say to someone considering joining a startup from maybe a corporate finance or corporate accounting background, joining as that first finance hire or controller? It's daunting. And I'd love to hear, like, what would advice would you give to someone considering making that jump? And then if they were to make that jump, what advice would you have for them in that first 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, I actually read something that was interesting about this. It was a podcast. It might have been a podcast actually with CJ Gustafson, Run the Numbers. He was talking about risk capital, and over time and in your career, and it, like, candidly, as somebody that's like pretty early in my career, it's very interesting to hear somebody who's got like 20, 25 years of career planning and execution behind them talk about this. They're like, you know, sometimes you have to build up risk capital where you play it safe for a while to get yourself into a position where it's okay to take some career risk. You know, it's okay to be like, I'm going to try and join this startup company that it might crash and burn, because the reality is it goes on your resume. And, you know, whether or not you like it, to get the interview, somebody has to like your resume. And to get the job, somebody has to talk to you. And so it's this like big tower of things. And unfortunately, the way that modern or current recruiting cycles tend to work is it always just starts with this resume. And so if you have this thing where like you join a series of startups that all flopped, because you like the high risk chaotic environment, like you're rolling a many, many sided die, hoping it comes up on one, right? Like it's not a good risk quotient objectively, but it is a very fun one to play. So I think what I would say to somebody who maybe has come from a more stable background, and I will also caveat this with saying that, like, I have no idea what that's like. I did public accounting and then I joined this job, and like that's what I got. So I've never been in a position where, I'm part of a larger corporate team where there is like clear delineation, and like been really deep into those situations. But I do think that podcast really had a good message that, like, if you are going to do something like that, make sure that you have the risk capital and that you're aware of the outcomes, right? Like you'll learn a lot regardless. I can promise you, if you join a startup, as especially the first in role finance, like, you will learn a lot of things, probably the hard way, really fast. The number of different like systems and processes and sort of people interactions and growth as a manager that I've had to do in the past 5 years, like I don't actually expect anyone that reports to me or comes in second to get exposure to that kind of thing. Like, to a certain extent, I feel lucky that I've had the opportunity and had the trust placed in me to sort of grow as the first in seat and to stay as sort of the head of the organization. I also don't think that's a given. But yeah, I guess like the simply put, I would say one, be prepared to learn a lot. Like be prepared to really swallow your ego, because things that you never thought would matter will become critically important. Like how quickly can you get this check to the bank? And be very sure that you're okay with the level of risk capital that you have, right? Like if you have a super stable job and, you know, I don't know, I was talking with my mentor a while ago, and he was talking about like job scorecards, like scorecarding your own position and how you feel about your job. And it's basically like, is your compensation right? Are you learning? Are the people that you work with good? And is the job right for your current life situation? And I think that's the thing that, like, especially with startups, becomes incredibly important because of how volatile the environment can be, is understanding, like, is your current life situation actually conducive to you going to, like, put it all out on the line? Because especially in finance, you'll be very aware of like where the end of the line is doing runway calculations. But I think that's something that you got to be like very real with yourself about. Like, are you willing to just like hit the end of the line on a job and not be bridging into something else super easily?
Moving to the sort of strategy and maybe the differences, you know, the experience for a business, whether it's bootstrapped, Series A, Series B, is so different. NAC was a bootstrap company for many years, and then you did the Series A. Tell me a bit about that. How did raising the Series A change the finance function, the strategy of the company, and maybe more specifically, just how you changed your approach to investment decisions?
Let me take that one piece at a time. So, like, first piece of that question, like, how did it change the finance function? I think when you're bootstrapped, especially at that size, like I said, we were probably about $1 million of ARR when I joined. The decision-making horizon, and this is something actually that I've been like thinking about a lot recently, so it's interesting that you ask. The decision-making horizon just isn't that far away. Because as a bootstrap company, like it wasn't even like bootstrapped with a massive like injection of like angel capital or personal capital. Like the whole thing was built on self-supporting revenue. So the entire thing was customer funded, which is a testament to like how much people needed this solution, still need the solution. But it meant that there's no runway. Right. Like at any given we're collecting cash up front annually, and there's a few, you know, as with when you sell to enterprise, there's always a couple of big customers that are a big concentration. But it meant that when we collected those customers, and, you know, you can predict within a month or two of like when that payment will settle, when you get the purchase order, whatever. You know, at max, we were maybe running 5 to 6 months of treasury. And so it's, you know, you tell somebody who's like used to running on venture capital, and you tell them they have 6 months to live, and there's like a panic attack, right? It's like, oh my God, we got to go get the investors together. We got to like come up with a story of like how we got here without needing to go to market yet. And like, why this happened? Why is this all happening super suddenly? Like, 6 months feels like a very like last minute thing to a venture capital finance team, where they're like, oh my God, we're going to die in 6 months. Who do we cut? How do you start like extending that runway? Versus being in a bootstrap company, you need to know that. It's a very important piece of information to know, like how long can you last if you don't collect any more cash. But it's like an overarching assumption. And so it's less something that you have to like engage with and deal with, and more something that you need to monitor within bounds. But what I will say is that a bootstrap company with that little runway, and I think it's probably pretty normal, like if you don't have angel investment, if you don't have a war chest to sit on, if you're bootstrapped, like I don't know how you would wind up with more than like even a year of runway. Like, there's just no way that you're collecting that much cash over your expenses to build a product that people want. It just becomes something that you have to operate in, and it actually simplifies things in some senses, because your decision-making horizon, you no longer do this, like, where do I want to be in 10 years exercise? Where do I need to be in 5 years for that to be a possibility? Okay. What does a concrete three-year outcome mean for that 5 years to be real? And then you go back and do your annual budget and you start like breaking it down into quarters, like that whole exercise of like long range forecasting and planning. It doesn't exist when you only have a year's worth of cash, and like, you need to execute on the customers that you have right now to get more cash to be able to hire an additional dev to handle the additional bandwidth to build something that somebody's asking for. And so in some senses, I do think it actually simplifies some parts of operation, because there's no 5-year plan. It's just, we got our work set out for us in the next quarter, and we'll see where everything lines up in the next quarter, and we'll figure it out from there. So when you do go to raise, I mean, the decision to raise candidly was opportunistic, which I think is the best way to raise. The best way to raise is always like, I'm going to do this because it's the outcome odds are basically the best in my favor right now. Like rather than getting to the end of your cash line and being like, okay, well, I need another investor to give me another X million dollars. It's much better to be in a position where like, hey, I have a real story about why I need more money, and I don't actually need it, but I'm going to ask them for it because it would accelerate some outcome, some theoretical outcome. And then you're selling them that story. So because we were bootstrapped, we were by default sort of in that position. I will say bootstrapped cash positive. If you're bootstrapped cash negative, you got bigger problems. But we also opportunistically were like, you know, kind of watching the Bessemer Cloud Index and like seeing these multiples get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And we kind of, I will say, we threaded the needle on like, how close can you get to the height without starting to hit the dip? So our raise was November 2021, and like the multiples didn't really get much higher than November 2021. Like November, December, by the time you hit January, you hear about the Ukraine war and everything falls apart. So yeah, I think in terms of how you think about finance, like that, the horizon of decision making, and this is something that I've had to like try to get my head out of, the like 3 months is the end of the line thing. Like that was very built in after whatever two and a half years of operating at NAC. And so I still continue to sort of need to get myself to push myself to look further, to like set structure, to get further out, get your decision making structure further and further out. I think that is a really big thing. Like the FP&A function gets, you know, I was doing cash management and cash forecasting when we were smaller and bootstrapped, but the need to do wholesale budgeting and, you know, approval of spend overages and sort of more formal budget management that you see where there's venture capital involved, it wasn't really necessary. And I sort of had to learn how to do that. And then also learn that that wasn't something that I had a ton of reps in, and learn that I needed to hire somebody to do it better than me. So that was another, that's more just like a personal learning rather than like how a finance department generally evolves. But yeah, like the importance of FP&A becomes really apparent when you're burning a bunch of money and your investor's like, okay, but what are we getting out of it?
So it sounds like, as you said, more pressure, a lot more focus on like, what's the ROI of what we're doing. Sounds like you initially shortened your time horizon to manage the capital, but now are sort of working to lengthen it. And then you obviously talked about budgeting, and I'm curious, like it's a hot topic everywhere, finance teams, in startups, you know, how do you balance having adequate control and visibility into where the company is making investments and how it's spending its money, while also empowering people throughout the business to move quickly? How have you found that line at NAC, and what's the philosophy or any best practices you'd share with someone trying to find that line? And I'm inclined to believe a lot of people are trying to find that line.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard line to find. I will not claim to have found it. I think, as with most things that require balance, it's, you very rarely stop on the line. It's a game of constant overcorrection, and it's just going a little bit too far in one direction, a little bit too far in the other direction, a little bit too far in one direction, a little too far in the other direction for one reason or another. And I think that's probably a fundamental truth, that like in anything that requires balance, I'll make a bit of an offbeat analogy here, but I slackline a decent amount. For anyone that doesn't know what that is, it's basically you put like a piece of webbing or a rope between two trees, and then you try to stand on the rope and walk between the two points. When you see people slacklining, it's not nobody just like stands rigidly perfectly balanced in the middle and just like fucking laser cuts straight down the middle. It's people are just like doing this constantly. They're just like constantly back and forth. Nobody's ever actually in the center. They just have enough like wiggle room going back and forth. And I think that's probably an apt analogy for like how you actually make that balance. I would argue that how you actually go about making those wobbles back and forth is actually going to be super variable depending on who needs to let go of the reins, which basically boils down to like, who's your CEO, right? Like some CEOs, the finance department is basically like, they're a set of reins and a bridle on the CEO who just like wants to go, 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 go. And you're like, well, no, you can't do that. You'll run out of money in 8 months. Other CEOs are hyper conservative, and it's just like, we need to have cash in the bank. And it's like, well, yes, you do need to have cash in the bank, but you also, like, as much as it's like a adage that people just throw around, like, you got to spend money to make money. And that is a real thing. I think especially in software or also venture capital funded software development, where you're often out ahead of your skis, because if you aren't, somebody else will take that bet and they'll get in front of you, and they might crash and burn. But that's the game that you're playing, is like, who is better at balancing on the front of their skis? And you know, investors now more so than in 2021, like, want to be able to see you get to the center of your skis a bit more. But it is still, at the end of the day, it's a game of enterprise speed. Like, how fast can you really go? So yeah, I don't have any like really solid pieces of process on like, how do you go about doing that? Because I really do think it will be super dependent on who you work with and the sort of financial habits that the organization built to get to where it is.
Makes sense. No easy answers, but I really liked the analogy you used about the tightrope. So this idea of balance is what you strive for, but you're never perfectly balanced. And maybe the takeaway here is, try things, see what works, be okay with the course corrections that will come along the way, and try to course correct fast enough to not fall off the rope.
Insert one thing, I'm actually very curious, like, for you as a CEO, like, how does that actually affect you? Like, if somebody comes to you, let's say Brendan comes to you and says, hey, like, we put this procurement process in place to like sort of automate the decision making around like what can be renewed and what software can be purchased or whatever. And like, you know, it meant that we didn't have to make as many decisions or whatever, but then, you know, we actually, through some loophole in the process, we wound up spending $200,000 more on software than we meant to in the past 6 months. How does that for, I mean, just you as a person, like barring CEO, like I think every CEO is a very different person, but like, how does that play into your own, like your own view as a CEO and your own personal capital spending preferences? Like, how does that, how do you feel about that?
About overspending by $200,000 on something?
Well, I would say more by like overspending as a result of experimentation that didn't go well.
Yeah, it's a great question and like definitely one that we're trying to find the line on. I mean, I'll start with the premise for us, which is like we're a big fan of the Netflix No Rules Rules book. And so one of the things we talk a lot about is this idea that the people in the business, and that means folks in product, folks in sales, folks in operations, are really the subject matter experts on the front lines that actually have the best idea of what opportunities we have to invest in and what we can get for those investments. And I think that leads to a philosophy internally with our finance team, and Brendan does a fantastic job of this, which is finance is not a gatekeeper. It's a partner. It's actually an internal services team that is accountable for the financial plan, but they're also there to engage on the front lines, make sure that the really big opportunities that our frontline teams see can be resourced, and to partner with them to build those business cases. You know, hey, maybe if there is a big investment opportunity, but it's going to be a difficult one to get our arms around and justify, finance is taking the perspective of tell me about it and why it's a good idea, and let me think about how we could make this happen. So I think that to me is really important. Now, we don't do that perfectly everywhere, but that is, I think, unique and maybe different than some organizations. When it comes to trial and error and making mistakes, I mean, like, look, we're in the business of trying things and making mistakes. Like, that's going to happen. I would say we try to differentiate between bold bets and forced and unforced errors. So as an example, if we are going to run a marketing campaign and our point of view is, look, we're going to run this campaign, we've ring-fenced the amount of money we're going to spend, we shouldn't find out we spent way more than we planned. Like that, to me, is for the most part an unforced error. If you're intentional about where you allocate investment, we should at least be upfront and say, we're going to spend $150,000 on a brand campaign. Now, we might spend $160 or $162, but we shouldn't spend $280. That, to me, is a mistake. But as it relates to the results that come in, that's where you have to be open-minded to, did it yield the result we wanted? And if you're doing it for the first time, the chances that you're accurate are probably pretty low. But over time, you get better. And I think that for me, is where we draw the line, is to say, if we have a portfolio of investments we're making, what's on the end of the spectrum that's really predictable? So for example, the way we acquire customers, if we've been doing it in sales for the last 4 years in a playbook that we've tested, we should have a decent sense of the payback period and the CAC, and that shouldn't be a surprise. But if we're testing a new channel like referrals, the likelihood of that coming in as expected is low. And so I think that's sort of how we try to parse through the differences.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I'm curious. I mean, you know, we just talked about this. You shared the Series A. You shared how that evolved your thinking and how the function changed. Obviously, as you mentioned, like the world's changed a lot. It's 2024. We've had sort of very different macroeconomic condition. How have you changed your approach as a result of that? Is there a greater focus now today on, you know, savings and efficiency than there was maybe 12 or 24 months ago? And how do you balance growth with that sort of efficiency or profitability? Every CFO, every finance team, every CEO is struggling with this. Like, what suggestions or advice would you have for those trying to navigate growth versus profitability, or let's call it less profitability, less burn in the pursuit of growth?
One thing that I consider myself lucky given the current macro is that we do have bootstrap DNA. Like most of the leadership team here, the three co-founders at least, all sort of were there for the whole bootstrapping journey. I came in maybe halfway, latter 40% of the bootstrapping journey. And so a lot of the a lot of the leadership here has bootstrapping DNA, where there is, and I will say that this does actually cause some, we'll say good problems, but it causes some good problems where you're trying to stretch what is okay to spend. When you come from like a, well, I can't spend that because I'll be out of cash in 4 months, it takes a lot of cycles of saying, no, it's okay to lose some money because we raised money specifically to do that. It takes a lot of cycles of that, I think, to get an organization from a place where, I don't want to say like frivolity, but like being okay with spending some money to see what happens, basically. And I liked your sort of sentence there of like a portfolio of bets. I do think that, like, how do you balance growth and profitability? I think there are so many factors that affect that. Like if you're in a super noisy space, you're going to be less efficient. Like I was at Sastr last year in 2023, and it was a funny thing, but being there, I swear to God, there was only like six actual softwares there, but it was like 40 vendors, 7 vendors per software. It's like integrations as a service. There's like every single like Wrike, Workfront, Zapier, Monday, like, or sorry, those are all project management tools, but like there's like 6-7 major project management tools out in the space, in the world right now. And there's too many. Like, they can't all win. You can't all be industry leaders. Like, some of those have got to get folded into other vendors. And I think if you're in a space like that, like, the efficiency factor goes down by default, because it's most likely that just the biggest player wins. They just have the highest stickiness. They have the biggest brand recognition by virtue of being the largest. And so I think if you're in a really noisy space, the likely you probably need to get yourself and your investor prepared for an expensive war. I consider NAC to also be very lucky in the fact that, like, really, we have, like, other than the status quo, like, don't get me wrong, status quo has major clout in our industry of just like, don't do anything, buy an email template and use that. Which is, having now said it out loud on a podcast, don't do that. It's a terrible plan. Get an email builder. But like, we have like one major software competitor, really, like people that like seriously come up against us in competitive deals for software alternatives. We have one competitor. And so we can afford to be much more on the like lower, or I won't say lower growth, but like less growth, more efficient side of the spectrum. We can afford to play in that space because we don't have seven well-funded competitors out there burning money trying to take market share.
All right, Chris. So I hear and understand you're really big on the topic of automation. And that's something we spend a lot of time thinking about at Float. What's your thought on automation right now in the finance space? Is there more of an appetite for automation in the finance profession before? What are your thoughts on that and where the industry is and where it's going?
Yeah. I'm a super lazy person. So I also get bored really fast. So things that can be automated, I have a real beef with doing them manually, probably to like a self-detrimental extent. Like I'll automate things that like don't need to be automated. You can ask. I wrote a Google Sheets formula to pull the live FX rate, because I hated having to go into like the Bank of Canada thing and like look it up. So I probably over index on this to a detrimental extent. I think there is availability for automation of many things in finance. I think one thing that's very problematic about automation in finance is that finance basically sits at the center of all data. If you are in a small enough finance org, you have access to all the payroll data. If you ask somebody or you know how to use SQL, you can get anything out of your product data. You have all of the financial data. You're the only one that has all of the financial data. So you can get product data, you can get people data, you can get financial data, you can get sales data out of the CRM. And I mean, automation is basically just linking data together to make a repetitive outcome, right? The thing about automation is that it requires clean data. And I think especially in the startup world, I mean, we're at like north of 10 million now, which is great to see, but it's getting to the point where like we've produced a certain amount of data, but early on, really intense data hygiene doesn't matter so much as just like being able to sell. Like you sell, you stay alive, you know, data hygiene is like not a primary thing, but when you start getting into like wanting to have really intense predictability, and automation around anything, your data needs to be super consistent and you need to have really high data hygiene. So I will say that's the first thing, is that if your data hygiene is bad, you won't be able to automate anything. I think a lot of solutions around automation, if I think about like invoice automation or analytics automation, the like whole ARR analytics space is another like hyper competitive space where there's like a million competitors and I don't really see any real differentiation between them. Let me say this. I think in finance broadly, in terms of automation, you're relying on kind of one of three things. One of them is like internal engineering resources to like help you write code to automate things. Pretty unlikely, very expensive, and probably a bad use of the engineering time that your company has. Two, you're like teaching yourself some basic SQL or coding, Python, whatever, to like write scripts to do things. Not everybody's interested in that. Also, probably like not necessarily what you want your finance team to be super good at. I did hear a podcast once actually with the CFO of Figma, and he said he won't let anybody work in his FP&A department that can't pass a certain degree of SQL proficiency. And I was like, that's hardcore. I think in FP&A, data proficiency, like data language proficiency, is probably more important than it necessarily is in accounting. But so yeah, you can either like steal dev resources internally. You can make yourself into a mediocre dev resource for data purposes. Or you can rely on third-party tools. And the third-party tools, I think with automation, what you need to realize is that you are essentially relying on their data model. And if you, especially with revenue, I built a SQL engine to parse our Salesforce records into an ARR waterfall, because I basically hated all of the ARR engines that I had been demoing and talking to. And it just like, in terms of like total cost of the platform and like flexibility post-implementation, I just like couldn't bring myself to accept it. So I built my own thing, which again, maybe automation to detriment. But I think that automation and finance generally in tech is probably decades ahead of most other industries. Like if I think about like the number of tech companies that I would expect to receive a check from, it's zero. But you know, we're dealing with the enterprises of the world, and you get checks from pharma companies, you get checks from financial services companies, you get checks from consulting, like the largest consulting companies in the world. They're like fucking ink signed. Somebody printed and cut a check, wrote a number on it, and then somebody else, two other people signed it, and then somebody put that in the mail. Like that's insane. But the need for financial control, I think, especially in publicly regulated companies, sort of forces some of this stuff. I don't know how effective it really is. Like you could just have a dual signature release in a payables platform, but it's I think it's the short, this is going nowhere. So what I will say is that it's all over the place. I think it can be whatever you want it to be. And that is really dependent on your own propensity to spend money on third-party tools or spend time teaching yourself how to do it yourself internally, learning Python or SQL or whatever. I do think that in really large companies that are old and sort of stuck in the past, the automation is abysmal, even in the largest companies in the world, which is funny as a small company when you like see how bad their systems are because you're on the receiving end of it. But yeah, I don't know if that really answers the question about where I think automation is in finance. But yeah, I guess the short answer is that I think it's all over the place, and it is basically wherever you want it to be. If you are the leader of your finance department, you can enable or suppress your people as much as you want to around automation.
Thanks for sharing. Well, Chris, it's been great having you. To wrap up, we'll do some rapid fire questions if that works for you.
Yeah.
On the theme of automation, what is one workflow, manual workflow, you want automated?
What is one manual workflow I want to... Oh, God, our invoicing. Holy cow.
Invoicing.
Our invoicing, we implemented Maxio a while ago and then ripped it out because I hated the analytics in it. And we haven't really put in a new tool since because we have really low... We have really large dollar invoice... really large dollar amount invoices and not that much volume, but it is getting to a point now where like my team is spending a disgusting amount of time just like drafting invoices in QuickBooks and then sending them out.
Yep. What's the craziest thing you've ever seen someone try to expense?
So I haven't seen anybody expense anything too crazy. There was like definitely some like several $100 bottle service at a club that I was like, nah, you're an idiot. Don't do that. I'm not paying for you. But stories that I've heard were two things. During COVID, a certain unnamed company shut down their office and sent everybody home. And they forgot to lay off all of the office related staff. And so for 8 months, there were, I think something around like 20 full-time staff, including like cooks, cleaners, office managers, like 20 full-time staff that basically just had their job taken away from them because they were only relevant in a full-time office setting. And then the company just didn't realize that those people were still on full-time payroll. And so they basically got an 8-month free ride before somebody started being like, hey, why is the like office department cost not gone to zero? And then somebody made the awkward realization that there was 20 full-time staff sitting at home doing nothing.
What's a podcast, conference, or other favorite resource you'd recommend to the audience?
I don't listen to a ton of podcasts. I'm going to put a plug in here for my peer community. I'm part of a peer community called the Operators Guild, which is a like BizOps finance peer community for sort of director and above level individuals. And I think it's actually pretty much global at this point. It's largely focused in the States with a big concentration in SF, but there's probably about 800 people in it now. And it's just an amazing resource for like a brain trust of every scale of everything that you could ever possibly want to ask in finance and biz ops. And if there isn't already a post on it in the forum, if you make the post, you'll get 5 to 10 answers. It's incredible.
That's awesome. And then lastly, who's a finance leader you admire and why?
Who's a finance leader I admire and why? Man, there's a decent number of them. How do you pick one? Well, I will say my mentor, his name is Jim Cook. He was one of the OG people at Netflix, one of the OG people at Intuit. He was the CFO at Mozilla for a while. He's just a person who is, I think he's very good at the people side of finance. He's very good at the finance becomes less and weirdly less and less about numbers the better you get at it, I think. And he is somebody that has really mastered that, and I hope one day that I can be as effective at managing the soft side of finance as he is. I think another two other shout outs I'll give is Longdin at Ada. He's just such a down to earth guy. He's the CFO, and I think he's really sort of a self-made man. And he's just so down to earth and there to help the people around him. And I think that's, again, kind of the leader that I want to be, is somebody that is there more to lift up the people around them than to sort of be in it for solely self-gain. I think everybody needs to get their stand up for themselves. But and then the last one would be Alamin Malik, who's at Posh Technologies. And Alamin is a little closer to me in his career than Long is, but he's just been a really awesome, very candid sounding board for me in all of my am I going crazy moments of my career. So yeah.
Thanks for sharing. I mean, mentorship is key. Sounds like you've got a great network and some top folks to admire. So Chris, thanks a lot for doing this. This was a blast. Lots of wisdom packed into the hour, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to chat with me and record this.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It was super fun chatting, Rob.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Retained Learnings. We want to reach as many Canadian finance professionals as possible. So if you have 2 minutes to spare, we'd love for you to rate and review the new show. Sharing on social media helps too, and you can tag @Flowcart. I'm Rob Kazam, and until next time, take care.